This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Our guest is Kyle Dargan, and he is author of a book called The Listening. And here he is with an opening poem.
Search for Robert Hayden. The garage has not been allowed to breathe for months now. The smell of moving, uprooting, cures in the arid Texas heat. Sense not to be romanticized, but handled carefully so that no boxes topple. We are looking for the middle passage. First, we must clear a walking path. Books yelp like kennel pups through the holes in their crates. Books that are no longer books, but subheads and chimeras of collected poems. Next, copacetic, victims of the latest dance craze. All originals bearing signatures like birth certificates. Clifton, no gray. Kumanyaka, with beard. Edie, looking young as the lost member of New Edition. Most out of print and born before I was pressed and fleshed. The past presented, Hayden is still hiding somewhere. Putting an ear to the walls doesn't help. This year-old house barely knows its own nooks and stashes. Hell, round them all up. In minutes, we'll be standing knee-deep in the unselected poems of Black literature. This is how we will find him, on our hands and knees, combing over flailed books, seashells beneath a forgotten tide. Occasionally, we'll wrench something up, not what we are looking for, and read it anyway.
That is the voice of Kyle Dargan, round them all up. Kyle, I have been following your work from a distance, and of many of the people of your generation, you are outstanding because you truly believe in the role of the poet as the changer, as the statesman in society. For a person so young, am I reading you right?
Well, I do aspire to a little bit of what Yeats, I guess, saw himself as, you know, the poet senator, the poet statesman. Not saying I necessarily want a career in politics, but if you're a poet, you're also a citizen, you're a human being, and thus you can't completely remove yourself from that aspect of life. And if you can do something really good, you can find a way to incorporate that into your writing to some degree.
Kyle Dargan is an assistant professor of literature and a member of the Creative Writing MFA faculty at American University in Washington, D.C. His first collection of poems we started hearing today was called The Listening. It won the Kaveh Kahnem Prize, and a new book was just selected by the University of Georgia Press, and that's Bouquet of Hungers. That's a great title. As we get to know you, please let us have another poem. Kyle Dargan, I'm Grace Cavalieri.
This is a short poem called Entropy. It's for my friend Teresa, who deemed herself the queen of randomness, and thus the poem is dedicated to her. Entropy for Teresa. What if our alphabet was full of atoms? I would speak in moles, spill more in my sleep than a drunk crier's convention. Hear ye, I could not be silent. Silence translates into everything and nothing, like the atom in fission labs where atomic models brace on wooden bones. And what if atoms left fossils? They would be an ornate script, illegible across all our faces.
Is that from the new book?
Actually, this is from a new manuscript.
A new book.
Yeah, the new
book. And what is that book going to be called?
Right now, I'm calling it Logorrhea Dementia, which is, I was listening to the Tim Russert show, not Meet the Press, but the other show on MSNBC, and David Brooks was on there talking about the election this year. Now, we've gotten to the point where both of the candidates seem to have talked themselves insane, and I kind of felt that way with these new poems, so that's where it's going.
Let's have another poem from you from any book, one, two, or three. Okay. Kyle Dargan was a Yusef Komunyakaa Fellow at Indiana University, and he is the poetry editor of the Indiana Review. He is the founding editor of Post No Ills magazine. Is that just online?
It's online now, but we hope to do a print annual every year with the best writing from the web as well as new creative work.
And of course, the time-honored magazine, Callaloo, has been with us for years and years. I remember it from 25 years ago. And he was recently the managing editor. But here he is as the poet himself, Kyle.
This poem is called Tesserae, and it's about a ritual I started since I've been in D.C. on Martin Luther King Day. I usually go down to the Lincoln Memorial and just sit on the steps for a while. And this poem is about the first time that I did that. So Tesserae, January 16th, 2006. Having woken with the long pool in mind, I dressed and met January. To honor is to walk on this day, march with no chorus of feet. Holiday gas, holiday money, all burn in America's engine. The fire, they say, keeps us free. Red and wet, my nose by the time I've hoofed to Washington's exclamation. Red, black, and green, a Muslim journal, I'm tossed by the horseshoe honoring World War II. My feet fall between the trees' bare harmony, though divested, their branches all look same. I come to reflect King, but my eyes pan for brown skin. Correction, I come to be reflected, multiplied by this prism of marble and water, framed water mimicking sky. What is cropped by the pool's borders might extend forever as we. Beyond the emulsified edges of King's image, his dream stands on this stone, a rich static of Negroes waxing black, turning Afro, painfully American beneath their skin. Turn to today, where we see them as one through nostalgia's oculus. Look back, look same, weren't we in sync then, in step, steeped in names of blood? There is no struggle coded in black marrow. There is no black marrow, simply blood and steps to spill towards least resistance, like water. History's icy headwind fought me for this memorial, and this day's pregnant memory of nearly a blood and bone man. I win something here, even if none like me share witness. The stone's cold bites through my denim, while beside me, a father reads from chapped hands the speech locked inside the stone's gray beauty, so his daughter may see herself in it, a moment united before we all leave as strangers.
That's Kyle Dargan. We're at the Library of Congress, and this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Kyle, significant in your work is a kind of bravery where you're pushing history forward all the time and the culture, pushing the culture and the strengths forward. At the same time, you have said that you are uncomfortable with exceptionalism, being in the accepted place. Cave Canem was an example. You have had a wonderful, you have reaped wonderful benefits, and yet you dream of a time when we will not have to separate people to give them awards. Have I read your mind correctly?
Well, I mean, the reason that organizations like Cave Canem start is that there is some ill or something that needs to be addressed in terms of, especially in this case, cultural representation. And the tricky side of that is that when you create an organization like that, I believe you have to create it with the hope that one day you won't need the organization to exist anymore. That when you start an organization like that, your hope is that one day the organization, in cooperation with other organizations, is successful enough to defeat that ill that initially required or asked that the organization be created. So I think it's just that you just can't get too caught up in the idea of, like, and I don't work for Cave Canem, so I don't speak for the organization. I'm just a fellow. But I say I like to think that we're not just so much focused on Black poetry, I mean, a lot of it is nurturing, fostering the work and career of Black writers or African-American writers. But to me, it's more so about broadening the idea people have of American poetry. And so that's what I think we have to keep our eye on the fact that we're not just here working solely for African-American writing, but we're working to help make American writing more inclusive and have more people aware of the breadth of American writing. So it's kind of like,
do you see that happening? I think I see that happening.
No, I mean, slow. I see it happening, but at the same time, I don't think that the idea of the canon is changing. So I mean, I think on the ground level, sure, it's changed a lot. I mean, when you look at what poets are winning, what prizes, you know, what people are being invited to read here or judge this or teach at these different universities, I think. But at the same time, if you look at it at the 101 level, as I like to think, is kind of like, you know, where we first introduce people to literature, is it changing there? And if it's not changing there, then it's still a problem because people go forward into their study of literature and culture with an idea that it's still the same canon, like the words that you need to know. The hasn't changed since God knows when.
That is an important point. And those of us who teach literature in colleges have to keep that in mind in setting up their curriculum. Let's hear another poem.
Read something, a bit of a change of pace, a little funnier. This poem is called I'll See It When I Believe It. And it's a result of, I took a statistics class. When I first got to American, I wasn't just teaching. I was taking courses in arts administration. And I had to take a statistics class. I had never taken statistics before. And by the time I got to the end of the semester, I had the feeling that basically you can prove whatever you want with statistics based on the way you frame it. So I lost a little respect for it as a discipline. But, you know, I see its usefulness too. So this poem is kind of me working through that. And it opens with a quote from Ricky Bobby from Talladega Nights, which is 98% of people will die sometime in their lives. I'll see it when I believe it. Statistically, one can prove an airplane commute to be safer than train travel. But the statistician walks to work, as on foot, he is 3.5 times more likely to meet the potential mother of his potential children. Remembering this, he can only muster a smile for every fourth woman with whom he manages to share eyes. At the bread shop, he forces a stare through the baker's lenses, yet he longs to decipher her hands, to know if the powder there is sweet or chalky. Though, statistically speaking, incorporating food into procreation is a bad idea. We all actually taste alike. All fricasseed in life's ancient roux, though statistically fewer perish from hunger than specific thirst in this world draped with water. While all data suggests more sinners walk among us than in hell, where there are no pencils and the dead never bother to return the surveys.
Is that book number three?
Yeah, that's book number three.
Let's keep going, man. Kyle Dargan.
This is a really new poem. You don't read really new poems, but I wrote this coming back from a family reunion in an airport. Airports are usually good for writing for me for some reason. And of course, there's reality TV on the airport television. So this poem is called For a Fee. For a fee, I will undress and wire stitch your quilt of needs to mine. Fly the impromptu banner from my spine's flagpole. For one fee, I'll prop myself before reality's video cameras until I'm famous for breathing. But for more, a next trick, I'll swan dive and seat myself on a fish tank's floor while water subdues my lungs. Rest me for one day atop revenue's pallet, then shroud and ship my body to my mother. For a fee, of course, I expect you would write her my death notice. Tell her I died saving you all from drowning. That beneath water, I spun then stilled slowly like a coin dropped on its side.
You seem to be inspired by geographic locations. Martin Luther King Day, you go to a certain memorial and sit. You're in the airport and you're inspired. Does place seem to trigger some sort of creativity in you? And would you counsel your students to do that?
I don't think it's place as much as it is movement, you know, because if you're in the same place all the time, you're going to write the same thing. I think it's important for writers to change their environment, not constantly, as seems to have been the case with me. I mean, my thing is I'm from New Jersey. I would like to get back to New Jersey, but nobody wants to give me a job.
Really? You'd like to get back to New Jersey?
Yes,
it's the best.
I love New Jersey.
I do too.
I love Newark. But the thing is, since I left for college in Virginia, I haven't been able to get back. I went to Virginia, then I went to Indiana for grad school, and then I came here. But also while I was here, when I was the managing editor for Callaloo, I was spending half my time in D.C. and the other half of my time in Houston and College Station. So I was constantly bouncing around, and then you throw in readings and writer retreats. So
Callaloo is not at Johns Hopkins?
It's published by Johns Hopkins, but actually the offices, we were operating out of Texas A&M University.
Oh. Other than that, when you approach your first creative writing class, and I saw that you are soliciting undergraduates, even from other colleges, to form a group at American, what is the first thing that you give to them when they're sitting around the first table on the first day?
Every year it changes. It's always, every year I come into the semester with like the new, okay, I've got it. This is the way to look at creative writing. I think before, my first semester I got there, we were looking at Plato. And this semester I'm looking at Bruce Lee because with his martial arts style, Jeet Kune Do, it's a form, but the point of the form is not the form, it's how you move your body within the form. And that's one of the things I, you know, always try to get my students to do is like, don't just write a form because it's a form that's empty. Like, don't just write a sonnet because you want to write a sonnet. Try to figure out, how am I going to populate this sonnet with my own understanding, my own emotions, my own feeling, the way my own voice moves? So for a lot of people, it's first just getting them to understand how their own voice moves. And then once they do that, you know, you can say, okay, now that you know how to do this, let me show you how to move it within this constraint of the sonnet or within this constraint of the villanelle. I don't think forms are bad. I like poetry in form when it's done by a person who also has an understanding of their own voice.
Well said, well said. He has had poems and nonfiction in many very fine publications, such as Denver Quarterly, the Newark Star-Ledger, Plowshares, Shenandoah, and as I said, Bouquet of Hungers is coming on. You've received many fellowships, and you've been to the Bucknell Seminar and Breadloaf, and you've also had scholarships, one of which is to attend the Fine Arts Work Center. Let's hear another poem. And then I want to ask you some questions about Yousef and Rita.
Oh, I'll read a poem about the Fine Arts Work Center since we just talked about it.
Is that in Provincetown?
Yeah, it's in Provincetown, which was very interesting for me because, you know, to be that far out on land into the Atlantic, I found myself thinking about that a lot while I was out there. And it was the first place I saw a whale that wasn't in a glass box. So that was interesting too. But the poem is called Quagmire. Forget the lily pads angled up out of the water. Green lids insects gnaw like winged goats. Forget the hawk who probably thinks the feeling mutual. Forget the pine needle garnishes, gnats bounding the pond skin. Mosquitoes engrossed in bloody games of tag. Matter of fact, forget green, the way it proliferates, the way it sways, reaches, turns brown. Forget the sky's false blue, light's refraction due to the angle it strikes atmosphere. Forget water, forget order, how biology all makes sense if you live long enough. The frog gulps the fly. The bird sucks back the frog. Sediment and maggots claim the dead bird. The seed feeds off the dirt. The tree nests the bird that eyes the frog. the cycle, the zero sum, the reason we build coffins.
That is beautiful, Kyle. That is one of your best known poems. Did you know that?
No.
Yeah, that is really an admired poem of yours. You said you sought mentors when you were going to further your studies, and Rita Dove was one person you wanted to work with. What is the one thing, if you look back, that you carried away from her? Just one thing that pops to your mind.
I really appreciated Rita because Rita gave me a lot of tough love, which is what, you know, I realized I needed as a writer. That, you know, I don't need to be coddled. I need someone who's going to tell me this is okay, but you can do better. And she was definitely one of those people. I remember being in her office one day, and I was talking about how there's this resulting space, you know, when you look at people like her and, you know, Youssef Kumanyaka, it gets weird with ages trying to lump people in these categories. But if you compare them to, say, you know, the Black Arts Movement and just how the voice of African-American poetry started to open and change in terms of like what you could say and what you could challenge and how you could be different. And
that's,
you know,
an essay. I would love you to write that essay.
Oh, no, I got enough to do. I'm the editor. Editors don't get to write. But I was looking at that and I was talking to her about the space and, you know, how there's, you know, I told her it's like the pendulum swings one way, swings another way, and then it kind of settles in the middle. And I feel like all the people of my generation are trying to figure out what happens when the pendulum kind of stills. Mm. And, you know, she didn't have an answer for me. She said, well, that's your job to go figure that out. And she told me to get out of office. And now she didn't kick me out, but she sent me off into the world to figure that out. So that's kind of what I, as a definite start in terms of the arc of my poetry writing career, is kind of that moment when Rita sent me out to kind of figure out what that space.
And you are
is.
Figuring out. You're writing about it. You're talking about it. You're editorializing about it. We would like another poem, please.
This is another, I guess, DC-inspired poem. Like I said, I'm from New Jersey, and there's the beginnings of gentrification in Newark, I guess, has started over the last couple of years. But when I came down here, it's the first time where I really saw, you know, a gentrification plan fully in swing. And I could see that there are people in Newark probably looking to bring this DC model up there. So I started thinking about gentrification a lot. So this poem is called Tour. The glass bottom poem floats on poured stone surfaces. The windows set in its belly show you nothing. No arcs, ancient relics, or species paved over. No more reason to bury here. People are small as shadows of the city. The city realizes the city and must forget itself to the ground to dream its hereafter, sparkling. See the pipes of yesterday. That is all the poem can offer. If you must see ruin, glance around, then step out quickly. Remember, resole your feet with the largest notes you carry, lest you disturb the city's voracious slumber. Letting. There was no time for socks this morning. I shed boots, bend down to see what hours of burning translate into visually. Skin rubbed shiny, gems embedded in the balls of ankles. In 3 days, flesh, like fantasy, turns gems into scabs. Plasma partitions to protect me from myself. But as night compiles hours, I'm tempted to break my own seals to stay awake. My foot perched stone still, blood beads into a mark of affluence, of wealth self-generated. A drop falls towards the floor, a marble, a Mars, a red so bottomless, no wonder our earliest healers felt a deep draught of this could fill the body back to living.
We would love a final poem, Kyle. One that you really don't want to leave without.
Okay, I won't leave without this poem. I have a thing against love poems. I don't write love poems. I don't like love poems. But I wrote a delayed love poem for an ex-girlfriend of mine who She made me this pillow one day, and it had a note inside the pillow, stitched inside the pillow, and I wasn't allowed to open it. It's called Dear R. Somewhere there is a loom in a fallow cotton field. The farmer and her husband watch the slack-jawed road, waiting for the carrier's moped, carrying their odd bounty, boxes of hearts. Some packed in scraps of denim, others with straw. The postman waits as the husband wrings some blood from each beating handful into the plowed rows before the hearts are repackaged and returned to senders. In 4 months, a box arrives, maybe just weeks or days too late. Inside, a white spool and a note jotted in the farmer's cracky script. This is the thread of your blood. Use it to bind what you fear is unraveling. Barely enough there to suture a smirking wound. From an innocent fabric, blue water, bubbles, and ducklings, you sewed a small pocket stuffed with firm synthetic down. You promised me all I needed to know percolated within that softness, which I wasn't to tear into, but, if rested beneath my ear, might speak. But as it held its plush tongue, we continued to fray. The incision is small enough. My finger scopes the pillow's belly. I slice again, widening the portal for the thing that was to save us 4 years ago. A note, like the farmer's, reading, I always will, but there was no spool of blood. This love you spoke of, is it like waiting in a room while your heart rests on the back of some courier's moped, with no idea of what will be sent in return, or if either of our addresses will still be true?
The one and only love poem by Kyle Dargan. You can get him on the web, Dargan, or through Googling Post No Ills magazine. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. That was the voice of Kyle Dargan. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and we'll be right back. We are back at the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and our guest is Sandra Beasley, and here she is with a poem.
Osiris Speaks. I left my heart in San Francisco. I left my viscera in the Netherlands. I left my liver on the 42 line, headed from Farragut Square to the White House. I left my occipital lobe in Reno. I left my corneas in Tangier. I left 1 foot in a courthouse and 1 in a traveling circus. I had hoped to find you, Isis, before the fish swam between my legs and swallowed, but now I navigate the Seine, sharing a scaled belly with the ashes of Joan of Arc. So I left my pride in Paris. I left a vertebra in Venice. On Murano, my clavicle became the mouth of a bowl. I left my mouth on Mount Everest, holding every apology I had meant to offer, and while they chattered in sad fury, I sowed my teeth in an Arctic field. Now there is little left of me, fingers with nothing to touch, hands with nothing to grasp. The small bones of my ears do their xylophone dance while the small cusps of my wrist bones pretend to be ears. Every king, in the end, is his only audience. Every queen picks up the pieces. Isis, every fish in that river is a child of mine. You are my net. Hold me.
That is the voice of Sandra Beasley. And wasn't Isis the one where all the souls had to go through to be placed into eternity, so there's a lot of energy you have to deal with, right?
Right, and Osiris had been dismembered, and in order to reincarnate him into his immortality, she had to gather up all the pieces, but the fish got to him first, and so in Egypt, there was a long historical tradition where fish was kind of looked down upon as a meal because it had already eaten one of their gods in a very private place.
That's what I like about your poems, because there are veils and veils and veils, and we just have to separate those veils, and we get yet one more tasty dish. Sandra has been serving as an editor with the American Scholar. She has been contributing as a writer to the Washington Post Sunday magazine, and she is the author of a book, Theories of Falling, which was the winner of the 2007 New Issues Poetry Prize, selected by Marie Howe. But this year has been very special because there have been three significant things that have happened to you. Every time I wake up, Sandra Beasley is like in front of me in neon lights. So tell us about them. One is Poets and Writers. That I know. Describe that.
Well, I can tell you exactly when I almost didn't make the application deadline. I mean, it was the day it was due, and I was in my office, and I had other things that I had to get done, and I thought, oh, you know, they choose one poet from all of D.C. There's no chance. And it was already 4:30, but I pretty much had the poems together, so I just kind of threw them in an envelope and ran out the door. And fast forward months, and I was doing a very dispiriting drive all the way back from Long Island, where the reading had been great, but my book wasn't out yet. It had gotten held up. So everything that could be going wrong seemed to be going wrong.
But what do you get from winning this thing?
Well, I got the phone call, and I get $500. I get a month at the Gentel Artist Residency in Wyoming. But the incredible thing is that what Poets and Writers does is they set up meetings for you. They put you up in a week in a hotel in New York, and you get to create a wish list of writers, editors, publishers, and they kind of put the foot in the door for you.
They further your career.
Yeah.
They get you an agent.
It's a very generous award, and I really like the spirit of it.
Well, it seems, do you feel that you're gathering light right now, and doesn't it make you a little scared, like what's next? I mean, it's like a meteor, and it is so much happening to you in 1 year. What do you feel?
Well, it could be a meteor or it could be a pendulum, and I think you just have to be prepared for whichever way it swings. I think that there's that trope where if you get one really good acceptance, you have to be prepared for the six rejections that will follow. And I'm enjoying this and trying to do the most that I can with the opportunities that have come my way. But I know better than to think that it'll be one long.
You're sensible. Here is Sandra Beasley. We're at the Library of Congress, and here's her poetry to prove it.
This is the opening poem from the book Theories of Falling. It's called Cherry Tomatoes. Little bastards of vine, little demons by the pint, red eggs that never hatch, just collapse and rot. When my mom told me to gather their grubby bodies into my skirt, I'd cry. You and your father, she'd chide. The way, each time I kicked and wailed against sailing, my dad shook his head, said, you and your mother. Now a city girl, I ease one loose from its siblings, from its clear plastic coffin, place it on my tongue, just to try. The smooth surface resists, and erupts in my mouth, seeds, juice, acid, blood of a perfect household. The way, when I finally went sailing, my stomach was rocked from inside out. Little boat, big sea, handful of skinned sunsets.
That is Sandra Beasley, and let's have another. The book is Theories of Falling, and who is the publisher?
New Issues. It was selected by Marie Howe for the New Issues Poetry Prize.
But it's at Michigan.
Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo. This poem is called The Angels. It touches upon one of the other themes that floats through my work, which is an interest in military culture. The angels. They have two noses, six eyes in the arch of each foot. They never tire of blinking down at the Americans, our surfboards, machine guns, our dancing hamsters. The way we shower every day, then rub more oil into our skin. One angel notes, there is no end to the number of things they can hydrogenate. One checks the spaces in bubble wrap to see if we store useful things inside. Every April, two men create a thing. Then the fruit flies start dying. By each November, one man has a button, and 4,000 men have the job of making sure he does not push the button. One angel notes, there is no end to the number of buttons. One visits 100 random bedrooms. His third ear records that, oh God, is still popular. He notes a rise in couples sleeping side by side, holding hands tightly. He calls this the Red Rover, Red Rover position. 4 are assigned to the homeless, and 10 to school teachers who tend to jump from bridges more often. The one in charge of soldiers sketches the long beard of Mr. Maupin, who swore he wouldn't shave until his son came home. Mr. Maupin sleeps in a blue recliner, still in his fishing vest, one pocket stuffed with lures, the other with laminated baseball cards of his son Matt's face. The backsides of each card shows an angel, all cookie-cutter wings and halo, yellow ribbons for hair, declaring not one left behind. The angel sighs and goes to sip whiskey with the angel of telemarketers. Every night, they watch lights dance across thousands of blue screens as if, they note, constellations. Every night they listen to the click of our million keyboards, toasting the sound American souls make as they collide.
Was his name really Mr. Maupin?
Yes, and his son's name was Matt, and he was for a long time the only U.S. Reserve soldier acknowledged as having been kidnapped. And his father insisted on not shaving any of his hair. So when I met him at a military event, he looked like a mountain man amidst a bunch of spit-polished people in uniforms.
In your poetry, some recurring images show up. One is the father, your father, Mr. Maupin. The father's a very strong image that comes into your work in a subliminal way. Also, there is the vulnerable, which is really very powerful. And then there is the body and the parts of the body that come together to make a fragility that turns out to be a very strong thing. Are you aware of all of these things consciously?
Well, I think that the biographical impulse is something that both tempts me and taunts me. I mean, I try to resist. I think I would feel both sorry, I'm apologetic to my father, but also vaguely wronged if somebody were to simply say, I feel like I know him from your work. I think that there's a lot of filters and prisms
Absolutely.
That the poets put people through. But that said, I would be lying if I didn't acknowledge that that is a presence in my work. And certainly the intimacy. I guess I think of poems in terms of intimacy, and whether that's of the body or of family, that to me is a fundamental impulse.
Mm. Let's hear a couple more. Her name is Sandra Beasley. We're at the Library of Congress.
This poem is about intimacy of a more surreal sort, kind of blind date with somebody from the past. Another failed poem about the Greeks. His sword dripped blood. His helmet gleamed. He dragged a gorgon's head behind him. As first dates go, this was problematic. He itched and fidgeted. He said, could I save something for you? But I was all out of maidens bound to rocks. So I took him on a roller coaster, wedging in next to his breastplated body in the little car. He put his arm around me, as the Greeks do. On the first dip, he laughed. On the first drop, he clutched my shoulder and screamed like a catamite. When we ratcheted to a full stop, he said, again. We went on the scrambler, the apple turnover, the log flume. We went on the pirate ship 3 times, swooshing forward, back, upside down, and he cried, Era! Waving his sword until the operator asked him to please keep all swords inside the car. He was a good sport, letting the drachmas fall out of his pockets, sparing the girl who spilled punch on his shield, waving as I rode the carousel's hippogriff, though it was a slow ride, and I made him hold my purse. On the way home, he said, "We should do this again sometime," though we both knew it would never happen, since he was Greek, of course, and dead, and somewhere a maiden rattled in her chains.
The personal within the myth, that's your style. And I see that you have had poems in, I would say, 60 or 70, maybe 100 journals already.
Well, I keep sending them out, and when I'm lucky, they take them. I actually have a bunch of poems coming out in Black Warrior Review sometime soon that are Sistinas. So I do write in forms, just not as of recently. But I'm finding myself returning to it.
Well, I think you're known for being accomplished, and that would call on the fact that you have to have form.
Yeah, I trained
in your canon. You have to move out from that. You have to have that first.
Right. I trained with Henry Taylor and actually Rita Dove, too, who's attentive to form, although it's not what she's known for. And I think that Henry always said very usefully, you have to know it, even if you just know it to choose away from it. So I think it's really important to have that rigor underlying the work, that sense of the skeleton of form, even if the flesh of the body is much wilder.
Well, he whipped you right into shape. But there is something in you that can't be tamed. So let's have that, Sandra Beasley.
Vocation. For 6 months, I dealt baccarat in a casino. For 6 months, I played Brahms in a mall. For 6 months, I arranged museum dioramas. My hands were too small for the Paleolithic, and when they reassigned me to lichens, I quit. I type 91 words per minute, all of them help. Yes, I speak Dewey Decimal. I speak Russian, Latin, a smattering of Tlingit. I can balance 7 dinner plates on my arm. All I want to do is sit on a veranda while a hard rain falls around me. I'll file your 1099s. I'll make love to strangers of your choice. I'll do whatever you want, as long as I can do it on that veranda. If it calls you, it's your calling, right? Once I asked a broker what he loved about his job, and he said, making a killing. Once I asked a serial killer what made him get up in the morning, and he said, the people.
Wow, what a line. Small, the word small, what does that mean to you?
Small in a compact way is wonderful. Small in a settling way, in a shallow way, is a danger of poetry. I resist poems that are mere descriptions, that are small in that they're content with the world as it is, and they don't want to throw something wild into the equation and see what happens then.
Let's hear some more, Sandra Beasley. The one thing I'm enjoying is the various forms on the page that you'll try for. I mean, you'll try anything. You will.
Well,
I see. Just
I
from looking
at Sistina.
Okay, just from reviewing your work, I see that you use the page so differently, so many times. Is that to keep yourself happy?
I do get bored if I don't change it up, and I like to write about different things, and I like to break my own rules. And this next poem, in a way, breaks a rule that I've held for a very long time, which is not writing directly about poetry in any way, not making a reference to it. But this is a Sistina that, in a way, tackles the art of why we write and how we write it.
Just briefly tell everyone what a Sistina is.
It's a prescriptive form in which you have 6 end words that you have to use in an exact order over and over across 7 stanzas, 6 full stanzas and an envoy. So it's a tremendously compressed and prescribed form. It's a kind of jigsaw puzzle, and it's great for insomnia. This poem actually takes an epigraph from Donald Revell, in which he said, "We must not look for poetry in poems." And it's called "Let Me Count the Waves." And if you want to listen for the end words, it's skirts, ducks, face, butt, home, and poems.
That helps.
Both butt and poems are words I swore I'd never use in a poem. Let me count the waves. We must not look for poetry in poems, Donald Revell. You must not skirt the issue wearing skirts. You must not duck the bullet using ducks. You must not face the music with your face. Headbutting, don't use your head or your butt. You must not use a house to build a home and never look for poetry in poems. In fact, inject giraffes into your poems. Let loose the circus monkeys in their skirts. Explain the nest of wood is not a home at all, but a blind for shooting wild ducks. Grab the shotgun by its metrical butt. Aim at your muse's quacking, pringled face. It's good we're talking like this, face to face. There should be more headbutting over poems. Citing an 80s brand has its cost, but honors the teenage me, always in skirts, showing my sister how to be the duck with a potato chip beak. Take me home, Mr. Revell, or make yourself at home in my postbellum reconstruction face, my gray eyes, my rebel ears, all my ducks in the row of a defeated mouth. Poems were once civil, but war has torn my skirts off at the first ruffle, baring my butt, or as termed in verse, my luminous butt. Whitman once made a hospital his home. Emily built a prison of her skirts. Tigers roamed the sad veldt of Stephen's face. That was the old landscape. All the new poems map the two dimensions of cartoon ducks. We're young and green. We're braces of mallards, not barrels of fish. Shoot if you must, but Donald, we're with you. Trying to save poems, we settle and frame their ramshackle homes. What is form? Turning art to artifice, trading pelts for a more durable skirt. Even urban ducklings deserve a home. Make way, or in the modern, make way, buttface. A poem is coming through, lifting her skirt.
To your credit, we couldn't tell that was a form. Sandra Beasley, this looks like it's a new book spread out on the table.
Yeah, I have a couple of projects going on. I have a manuscript that's pretty near to completion called I Was the Jukebox. And then with this recent Sestina project, I'm trying to figure out whether that's a section within the book because of it plays with the idea of musicality and repetition, or whether, you know, that's a different project, a formal project.
So some more for us. This is Sandra Beasley. She is working night and day as a professional poet. She's an editor, and she is a graduate of University of Virginia, and how does American come in there?
Oh, well, I came back to D.C., which is where I grew up after graduating, and Henry Taylor, who I had interviewed for an undergraduate literary journal back at UVA, had always kept track of my work, and I literally got a phone call from him that said, you know, this is what we can offer. Would you be interested in coming? And when you get a call like that from someone, you go.
From a Pulitzer Prize winning poet.
Yeah, it doesn't, I mean, it wasn't the most money, but you go.
You also have roots in Virginia, because I know that Claudia Emerson has a high opinion of your work, and that you've been featured on is it Blackbird?
Yeah, Blackbird's been really generous to me. I love Virginia. I affiliate with it freely. I mean, my family lives in Northern Virginia. I have a lot of family throughout the state. And I always think of you with Virginia.
Virginia's child. Let's have some poetry. Sandra Beasley is here at the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri.
This is another one of the Theories poems from Theories of Falling. This one is called Theories of Nonviolence, and it references the Waco sieges back in the early 90s. There's some amazing details from what those sieges used in the name of nonviolence. Theories of Nonviolence. A frightened rabbit kicks its hind legs so hard that it can break its own back. Someone thought to record that pain on tape. Someone said, shell this under non-violent tactics. just a line item buried in daily reports from the siege, after blasting Ozzy Osbourne and dentist drills, before using flash bombs and gunfire, they played Rabbit Death Scream, repeat loop. Officers wrote the wail was like a tea kettle's whistle, but endless. My father, in uniform, used to speak of war in terms of the sword and the scalpel. Scalpel, meaning we kill only who we meant to kill, meaning clean, meaning better. Sword, meaning we kill anyone who gets in the way. Even now, watching news of each new explosion, I wait to see if our flag flashes onto the screen. If not, there's that tiny, cool blink. Well then. An old lover calls to tell me they finally made him a doctor. First, do no harm, they made him swear. Then they said, to save that man, you'll need a sharper knife.
What did Marie Howell say about why she chose this book?
Well, it was funny. Her favorite poem, or at least the one that she chose to cite, was one that almost didn't make it into the book. It was a kind of runt poem called Fireproof. But I think what she sensed in it, which is part of the reason why I couldn't give it up, was just this kind of really lyric intensity that refused to let go of the story, didn't want the reader to get disoriented. She used the words clear and intent, and she said that I didn't want to fool myself or anybody else, which to me is a really high compliment. So it was an honor, and her book, What the Living Do, is a book that I think a lot of poets of my generation really read and reread and studied and loved in the way that it talked about the human experience. So it was I couldn't have been happier in terms of a judge.
Do you think the present poems are different from the ones in your first book?
I think they're a little less personal. In ways, they're willfully less personal. I was really interested in dislocating voice, still talking with a very real, very humanistic quality, but talking as a jukebox or talking as a long-dead god or talking about going out with the Greeks. I mean, I wanted to kind of stretch outside my own everyday world. So they're a little looser, they're a little funnier. A lot of them have been written as part of an ongoing project where I've committed with groups of poets to drafting a poem a day for a month at a time, even posting those poems, whether it be online or within an email
Your
list
blog.
We share with each other. Yeah. And so that's been a challenge and sometimes a head-banging, frustrating challenge.
Something good is coming from it, though? Does something good come of it?
I think so. I think you force yourself to really to not restrain yourself, to let it get onto the page before you make your decision about it. You know, when it's 11:54 and you've got a poem due by midnight, dangerous things happen.
Let's have another.
This one is based on an image from a Ouija photograph. He's a photographer. I don't usually like ekphrasis. I don't usually work from visuals, but I think he did a really good job at capturing both the before and after of a scene with a single shot. You are the whole building on fire. You are the voice of sirens. You are the dumb crowd milling the capture of Ouija's lens. You are flames licking up the escape. You're the hovering of a mother at the cliff of her window ledge. You are the choice to drop her baby. You're the chance of a beckoning crowd, six hands gripping a sooty raincoat. You are the only option. You're a simple drop. 10 stories below, they pray you're like a cloud, soft, floating. You are like a cloud, gray, and you don't hold anything. You are that moment before a falling, the falling, a whir of falling, a wail of falling, the sweet thud. You are black blood flaring across the concrete. You are the needle to the groove of a very sad song. The whole building burns with you.
There is a thinking part to your poem. Can we have a final one?
Certainly. Maybe it would be a good time to read the title poem, which is Theories of Falling. Theories of Falling. After years of research, I can only guarantee that if you go over Niagara in a kayak, you will die. A ball of chicken wire and quilts, you might make it. Oak Barrel, you'll walk away, though just to die in a poorhouse 10 years later. The odds drop above the 8th-floor window, yet even from 30,000 feet, a canopy of trees may catch you. Luck comes to fighter pilots and Czech stewardesses. Rotoscope cameras have captured the cat as he swivels, first head, then spine, aligns his hind legs, arches for impact. He turns this helix over and over until the ground rises to meet him. He bounces. We do not bounce. Not that we don't have a knack for certain kinds of falling, bringing a man home after 5 rounds of bourbon because the snow piled up and he has no coat. Leaving 3 friends to try hailing a taxi to Virginia while he burrows for warmth and says, you're so good to me. Hands diagramming every curve, a kind of sleepy, lustful mathematics. Swivel your head, align your legs, see if you can land on your feet. Sometimes an elevator cable does snap. There is an immediate heat, the squeal of atoms torn away. As you hurtle toward bottom, you may think, if I time this right, I can be in the air when it hits. From the outside, we see this makes no difference. What matters is speed relative to the earth, not the floor of the elevator. But you are not outside. You're in the cage, bracing your knees, blood coiling in your heels. So go ahead, jump for God's sake. Jump like your life depends on it.
The voice of Sandra Beasley. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The series is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions, post-production by MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making this possible. Our associate producer is Ken Flynn. Our engineer, Mike Turpin. I'm Grace Cavalieri.